Session number 13123, Cyril Mount, Reel 5.
We were talking about your time at Barilli and just the general conditions that you were facing. What about the effect of the actual climate altogether on you?
Well, being very fair-skinned and slightly auburn, I suffered a bit from the heat, but we had these topis. Solar topies, of course, which protect us from the bulk of the heat. And, I think everybody suffered from things like prickly heat and rashes.
How bad was prickly heat?
And some people came up all over rather like sort of shingles or something, you know. On the whole, you sort of accepted it, you know, like you accepted being saddle sore because you sweated a hell of a lot between your legs when you were riding and mosquito bites and all these other little irritations. But on the whole, I think the excitement of being there at that age overcame a lot of... I have no bad memories of that time.
Did you go to the hill stations every year?
The younger people were sent up the hills for a much longer period than the old. The oldies, I think, went up for about 2 or 3 weeks. I've forgotten exactly how long. And I think I remember being up there for about... 6 weeks.
And that was every year?
It was every year when you were under 20, I think.
What was it like? Which hill station would you go to?
Well, there were two. There was one called Dulacut and another Ranakut, and they were up there into the foothills from Dehradun. They were about 8,000 feet, both stations, and it was quite rarefied, even that high. You went up on Indian buses.
What was that like?
You went on an Indian train to Dehradun, and then you went on an Indian bus, which is sort of half full of Indians, with sometimes chickens on the roof and cans of ghee, which I rather like ghee now because I cook Indian food, but then it smelled revolting, and ghee and betel nut spitting and general sort of smell of India, you know. And so as you got higher and higher, what was the rarefied atmosphere and this smell and the diesel coming in the open windows of the bus, because there's no glass on the windows, it's just bars, you got very, very sick, and everybody used to stagger out, but much worse than being seasick by the time we got to the hill station. The hill stations were designed mainly for Tommies, I think. There was a YMCA and the Toc H, you know, these winding hills, and barrack. Well, they're not exactly barracks. They're more like Nissen huts, wooden Nissen huts, which were absolutely filthy with bugs. That was the biggest thing I remember about the kuds, as they call them, the hills. Bugs were these coir mattresses, which were full of them, and the beds. They even got in the cracks in the bed. So the routine every morning was to sort of bang the beds like mad with a large rock or stick, and all the bugs would fall out onto the floor, and then you'd just trample them to death. And then swilling the bed with paraffin. We had paraffin issues because we had paraffin lamps, so no electricity. And these coir biscuits, which are also full of bugs. There's no way of getting rid of the damn thing. You just went to bed expecting to be bitten.
Were you squeamish about it? Or?
No, we just sort of accepted them in the end. You know, you just sort of had your bug bites and you rubbed paraffin on, or Brasso. Brasso's a good... All round remedy for lots of things, to stop them itching.
What would you do while you were at the hill station?
Oh, you still did training. See, I was a trumpeter until 1938, October 38, which was when I became a man officially, and they gave me a stripe, and I became a signaller and became very proficient at reading Morse code.
How did they train you as a signaller? I don't think we've covered that yet.
Well, we had lamps, we had heliographs, and we had flags. There was no radio or anything like that in those days. And we became very fast, very proficient at establishing communication between hills, you know, sometimes over 20 miles with a heliograph. And I don't remember what the transport was, but people would go out on little exercises, and it was mainly signal training that went on for the people who were up there a long time. the lamp, was a powerful sort of lamp, and had the same stand as the heliograph, and sent out a sort of call sign and moved the lamp fractionally until you caught the other guy's lamp. He was doing the same thing, and then you had a sighting thing on top of the lamp, and you just lined up, rather like the Navy lamps, the oldest.
And it was all Morse.
And it was all Morse code, yeah. And we got very proficient, you know, you could read about 20 words a minute.
You had no trouble learning Morse?
No, I enjoyed that. Yeah, I was very proud of it. You know, there was a lot of competition there. You could read the fastest, you know.
So that was that. Did you carry on with your trumpeting at all, or would
no? No, that was finished. There was a young Anglo-Indian lad took over at that point.
So what would you be attached to then as Cygnus? Still with the headquarters?
I was still in headquarters of the
84th battery.
Yeah, that's right.
What about your relationship? You mentioned the Anglo-Indian. What about your relationship with the Anglo-Indians? They were a sort of separate community at one point.
Well, in the town, they tended to be the civil servants and the station masters, and they were very efficient. But I think there was a certain antipathy towards them, even in the regiment, in the battery.
Why was that?
Well, they tend to call them sort of half-chats and chili crackers and... You know, they're a bit derogatory about the fact that they... And the Indians, of course, didn't like them either, because they were very fierce on the Indians. They, particularly when they were in a position of authority, like being a station master. The station master would walk up and down with the riding crop, and the beasties, the water carriers and the sweepers, would be in a regimental line, you know. The water would be sprayed on the platform, and anybody who wasn't working at top speed got the riding crop across his arse. That doesn't happen now. I mean, Indian stations are filthy and disgusting. When I went back, you know. So they did a lot of good, I think, in one sense, but they weren't liked.
You didn't socialise with them then?
Yeah, well, no, we didn't socialise, and we tended to keep very much to ourselves. The general social interaction was within the battery. And possibly we had 1420th Hussars, and we sometimes would mix with them. If you went down into the city, you'd bump into them, and you might have a drink. There were no bars in the town. Well, what people tended to do was to buy a cheap bottle of Indian whiskey and then sit on somebody's veranda or the wall of one of these posh houses and just lug out the bottle. And like sort of skinheads nowadays, really, I suppose, and sort of just chat. And no, it was quite nice. Those years, I mean, the whole of 1938 and the whole of 1939 until the war started, I don't think we got much indication that the war was going to start, but it came as a surprise.
What about the European population there? Would you mix with them at all?
I didn't. The nearest I got to mixing with civilians was the Toc H that I had in the cantonment. Where you got very, I don't know if you got three cups of tea or it was cheap anyway. And it was sort of, you know, there were easy chairs and big verandas and punkers to keep the place cool, or fans rather, to keep the place cool. That was a place to sort of go and read sometimes newspapers from England, you know, months old, but old magazines. And the library, they had a library, a religious sort of Toc H library. That was about the most civilian thing I can remember doing.
So you wouldn't go to any of the civilian clubs at all?
Oh, no, they would be out of bounds. The officers did, yes. The officers mixed. They went. They played polo and they went pig-sticking, point-to-point.
What about the Indians? How did you get on with them, the actual Indians themselves?
Well, there was a tradition of despising Indians. You know, they were wogs. But at the same time, you liked them. You know, they were an inferior race, an inferior breed, but... You liked the ones that you came across. But, I mean, we did some cruel things. You'd go on manoeuvres with the guns, and they would deliberately sort of swerve the gun so the hub would catch one of the mud houses going through a village, you know, narrow maze, and the house would start to fall down. You know. And really dirty behaviour like that used to happen.
But you didn't see it as that sort of behaviour then?
Well, no, it's just a big giggle. It was loutish behaviour. I didn't do it because I wasn't a gun driver, but I mean, I don't think I did. I wasn't quite allowed. But there was a lot of real toughness. You know, the people that were the regulars of a long standing, a lot of them had been fighting on the Northwest Frontier. And the nearest I could describe them as they were like Australians. Because when we got to the desert, and we were alongside the Australian division, 1st Australian Division, and we got in remarkably well with them. We spoke the same language, you know, it was a mixture of Urdu and Arabic and a lot of swearing. And
Was there any problems with some of these old regulars who'd been out?
No, I think they were really great guys, a lot of them. You know, a lot of them, people who had histories, you know, they'd run away from something or other, wives or prison or whatever, you know. Some of them had been lumberjacks in Canada. They were really tough guys. And
Was there any cases of them breaking down, do lally tap, that sort of thing? I mean, were you aware of mental problems that sometimes...
No, that happened later. They were quite stable, I think. The Dulally thing, yeah, Dulally was a mental hospital. That's the name of the town, yeah. But, I mean, you talked about people getting tapped, or he's tapped, he's fucking tapped, you know. But they were tapped in a very knowing sort of way. They were mad, you know, and they're very tough. And I think that did a lot for me at that time. It was a toughened me up.
So that's sort of the way you lived. We've had a look at that.
Yeah.
What about any events that happened before the war started? Anything of note?
Yeah, well, the thing which still sticks in my gullet was... Immediately I was 18, I was given a stripe. This is almost de facto, and I was very proud. I was a very smart soldier, still polishing my boots now, see. And I was very proud of having a stripe. And, you know, I wrote home, I have now a Lance Bombardier, Mum, you know. And within a very short time, within a few weeks, I was in charge of... There was the main guard, and then there was the stable picket. The stable picket was also armed, rifled. And your job was to patrol and look at make sure the horses were okay. Well, I was in charge of a real bunch of hard-nosed old sweats, and I was sitting there and I was quaking because you weren't supposed to take your tunics off. It was summer, the KD tunics buttoned up to the neck. You were allowed to undo the two hooks at the top and no more. And you were allowed to lay on the bed. You weren't supposed to sleep. See, it was two on and four off. And these people took their tunics off, they got under the mosquito nets, and they were snoring, and I kept going around pushing them, come on, you know. But they were having, they took me for a ride, really, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting at this blanket-covered table, and suddenly in strides the orderly officer, full evening dress, he'd been on the piss and the mess, and, you know, beautiful dress, uniform, red stripe down his trousers, spurs jingling. And he's carrying a rifle like a piece of dog shit. And then without any words at all, he just beckoned me with his finger. And I stood up. Well, I was already standing up, and I followed him outside. There was the sentry, with his head between his knees, snoring, and he'd just taken the rifle off him like that. So he just said, phone the main guard room, tell them to... send two escorts down. You're all under arrest. He arrested the whole bloody bunch. How many were there? I've forgotten how many. The four, I suppose it was four people. Yes, that's what I ended myself. We were all under arrest anyway. Next morning, up in front of the CO, charged. I got my stripe torn off, and I was sentenced to 2 weeks in Lucknow military prison and detention barracks. I felt so angry about that because it was so unjust. You know. I think the other guys got 1 week. No, the ones who were not properly dressed, they got jankers, they got ordinary sort of defaulters. The guy who was asleep got 1 week. I get 2 weeks. So I marched, sort of go on the train with an escort and handcuffs, believe it or not, to Lucknow, and marched up to the gates of this prison up a steep hill. Handcuffs are taken off, I'm thrust inside, gates clang, and then it's double. And from then on, I never stopped running for 2 weeks, kneeling down, first of all, in at the top in front of the guard room, where this brute of a sergeant major started there with a horse clippers and went right back, took all my hair off, and then a blunt razor and scraped it. I had little nicks all over my head, sore, you know, he scraped my head, absolutely bald. And my best boots were all cut in this gravel, you know, and I was really so, it was awful. And, well, it, you know, we dug pits in the morning, and there was another group of people filling in the pit that somebody else had dug. And that's all it was. And we were cutting lucerne to feed the mules. They had mules. And then you'd go back, and you had no chance to sort of wash or anything. You just sort of tried to wipe off some of the sweat and grime, dressed in full kit, and out again on the parade ground with your rifle above your head, run, doubling up and down in the hot sun. Yeah. It was summertime, yeah. Really hot.
Were the guards brutal at all? Or?
Yes. The people at night were army physical training staff who'd been seconded to the prison, and they wore their little black slippers and their black and red striped jerseys and their tight trousers, and they would walk up and down. And if they just felt they didn't like the look of somebody, they would unlock. The doors of the cells were just iron bars. They just unlocked, and you'd hear this thud, boom, and people sort of, and if they made a noise, they got hit even harder. And they got beaten up regularly. I didn't actually get beaten up, but a lot of people did. And they would hit them in the stomach and the body, you know, so there's no marks. And they'd come along in the morning and they put a blunt razor on the bars, and you'd have to shave in about half a minute flat, and they'd come along and collect it all. Then it was a real punishment trip.
What were the cells like? Were you one per cell?
We were one per cell, and they're about 5 feet wide and about 8 feet deep. And there's a wooden bed with one blanket and a wooden pillow. This sounds unbelievable, and the Bible. But you never get a chance to look at the Bible, because they flung all these things in from the kitchens at night. Dixie and a dish at least. And you had to make that thing gleam as though it was chromium plated before you got into bed. And then when you got up in the morning, you had to lay all your kit out on this bed. I never forget that. In a way, there are even some parts of it that I can remember. I remember the minor birds calling, and with affection, you know, I can smell that there were blossom on the trees by the big wall with the barbed wire on top. And there were little things which I actually loved about it. It was almost as though I'd done a meditation, a long meditation, and I'd flipped over the nasty bit, and I was in a sort of bliss state in the end, because I was very fit. And in there, it didn't affect me, all this running about. You know, you had to run everywhere. You'd run for your porridge and run back again. That was great, in a way.
What were the other inmates like, and how many were there?
This was the detention barracks, which was different. The military prison was for people who'd killed Indians and robbed and done all sorts of things. We never saw those. It was called the military prison and detention barracks. Look now.
So the detention barracks would just be chaps like yourself, minor misdemeanors.
Short-term... sharp shock things, yeah.
Did you have much contact with the others?
Well, you know, we talk out the corners of our mouths while we were working. You got really beaten, kicked if they saw you talking. But I made friends with a couple of guys from Royal Fusiliers who were stationed in Lucknow, and we were all sort of kicked out together. And I had a pass to go back to my unit, and but I was so glad to be out. I went back to them, slept on the floor, and we got totally pissed that night. And I went back the next morning, back to Burley, which was hours on the train, and with an almost enormous hangover. And I almost got sent back again for being overdue, because they'd informed by telephone that I was on the way. So, but I didn't. I just got ticked off. I think they thought I'd done enough, you know.
So the next thing would be the outbreak of war, would it?
That was 38, just after, you know, after I was sort of, it was a hot, it was beginning to be hot in 39, so I was 18 in 38. It was April, May, when it was getting really hot, when this happened. Then September, the war broke out. And
now, you said you didn't have much idea of it coming. You hadn't been following the event.
No, you didn't get much news. You know, I don't think we had the same indication that people in Europe had that it was going to happen. And it was a bit of a sort of shock. You know, God, you know, what's going to happen to us? Where are we going to go? You know, we hadn't the Japanese hadn't come into it then. So I think we started training intensively then. We moved down to Meerut.
Meerut, that's...
Yeah, that is a bigger town between Burley and Delhi. And there were a lot more regiments there. We did a lot of training. We went on shooting manoeuvres to a place called Tukluckabad outside of Delhi. and we did live firing on the ranges and sleeping rough, sleeping out in the crisp night air. You know, it was quite nice. Actually.
Was the training realistic, do you think?
Realistic, considering we had horses. I mean, our job was we had a trumpeter, and my job was a visual signaller, and then we had the linesman, who had a reel of wire either side of the horse in a leather bucket. My job was to follow the trumpeter and the battery commander, Bobby Burns, who had a cork leg, and we'd go galloping off to really split-arting, I enjoyed this, to the observation, to find an observation post, find some high ground. Then he'd hand, and I would hand the horses over to the trumpeter, because that was his job then, was to be a horseholder, and he'd take them back to a discreet, safe place, and then my job was to get make contact with the battery. And it was, you know, a matter of great sort of pride that you know, sort of through set, you know, you got through pretty quick, because that they would be following where you'd gone, the dust cloud. You know. It was all very primitive. It was like Boer War stuff.
But no wireless or radio?
No wireless at all, no. Telephone. But then, maybe 10 minutes to half an hour later, the linesman would gallop up, and they'd gallop up with this line rattling out behind them in one hand, and they'd lay the line, and they'd put an earth pin in the ground and piss on it, and just a single line. That was always a mystery to me, because the earth provided the return to the circuit, and they would then.
They were a different sort of signaller from you then, the linesman.
Well, I could do the linesman stuff as well, but we were in two sections. So there's the people with the lamp and the heliograph, and the people with the wire, and they would get through, and then they'd attach the telephone to the wire, and from then on, the battery commander would be able to speak to the guns direct. But very often we'd be able to get a first sequence of fire orders down. There was a code for fire orders.
How did it work?
Well, it was a card, and sort of tape post was AE or something, and so you just said did, and then the whole lost, you know, HE charge for whatever it was, and then fire. I remember fire was WX, and then that was great. You know, you got through and you passed the whole sequence down, and then the shells come whistling over and to whatever target they'd chosen. But we were firing, there were four or five howitzers, old four or five, with wooden wheels, and iron-rimmed wooden wheels, and this is what we were using.
That's all you had?
Yes.
It was a howitzer battery?
Yes. And the other, there was one of the 78 was howitzer battery, which we then joined in Merritt, and 83 and 85 battery were 18 pounders, and yeah, it seems unbelievable. Didn't it? They still, you know, had the rope round, all blankoed beautifully, and the hubs of the wheels were polished brass, and everything was gleaming.
Were you aware that it was all First World War guns, and that things had moved on a little?
No, we weren't aware that anything had moved on. I think, you know, we didn't know there were any other sorts of guns.
So you'd moved down to Merat. Was life very different there, or much the same?
It was more intensive then, because I suppose some sort of order had come through about intensive training, and we were aware that we were at war, and sooner or later we were going to get involved in it, I suppose. And there was a Lancer regiment there, 17th, 21st Lancers. I think they got mechanised before we did. Well, the Hussars moved down with us as well. There was an infantry regiment, Oxenbucks Light Infantry. There was a hell of a lot of troops, whereas Merritt was an outstation with very few troops.
Bareilly was an outstation.
It was an outstation, whereas Merritt was a big city, and it was and a very big cantonment of troops.
Just before we go on, just come it on you. One thing we missed out was you had another attack of malaria in 1939 before the outbreak of war.
Yeah.
If we could just cover that now then, because this was you'd had mild malaria, and now you've got the more serious.
Well, there was a BT malaria and MT, but I never knew what the difference was really, except that I seemed to be in hospital longer with the MT, the malignant tenens, or what they call it.
But the symptoms were just the same.
The symptoms were the same. Yes, it was sort of hallucinating, and there was part of it that I enjoyed. I knew I was being looked after. I knew I wasn't going to die, you know. And so I used to lie back and enjoy the hallucinations and the Yeah, the sweating and the shivering wasn't nice, but you know, when you got over that, you know, you pumped full of the it was Mepicrin and they still used what was the
quinine. Stuff?
Quinine, yeah, and then this Mepicrin stuff came in, but somehow the drugs seemed to make you in a nice sort of floating state. It was a relief to get off duty, sort of thing. Yeah.
And this was while you were at the Hill Station that year.
No, I had malaria. I never had malaria in the Hill Station. I had typhoid in the Hill Station.
How did you come to get typhoid?
Well, we were allowed to go off for a few days at a time, you know, to be adventurous. There was a big river about a couple of miles away where we would go and sort of and catch fish, you know, like the Indians did, by throwing boulders onto other boulders under the water, and the fish would be stunned and come up. And we'd make fires and cook the bake the fish through, sort of putting a stick through them and that sort of thing. But we went further. We got I think it was about 3 or 4 days leave with this Anglo-Indian chap, and the two of us went a lot further than that. And we made the mistake of, he was all right, he seemed to be immune, but we drank water that was given us in the villages that we passed through, and we ate fruit from there without bothering to wash it, and so somehow or other I picked up this anyway. And luckily, by the time I'd started sort of really hallucinating and feeling absolutely dreadful in every limb, we were only about a mile or so from the camp, and we were coming around a narrow track around the side of this quite steep hill covered with padded pine needles. I can remember that, and he was more or less carrying me. I don't know, arm around his neck, he was hobbling along. He got me back anyway, and when it was diagnosed, I was stuck in this isolation hut down in the valley. I think everybody had a panic on them that they were all going to get it. But yeah, I was nursed through that by a Sister Campbell, the Queen Alexander's Imperial Military Nursing Service. She was marvellous, yeah. And another guy, an orderly.
How long did it take?
I don't know, it seemed to be weeks I was in there.
Now, going back into the war then, you were going through 39 and into 40. When were you mechanised?
Well, yeah, that's what I was coming to. It was 41, early 41.
So up until then, life had sort of continued?
Life had continued, much as though it was still peacetime in a way.
Just more training?
There was more training. There was this training without any end product, as it were. We didn't know where we were going, we didn't know when we were going, we didn't know what was going to happen to us. I don't know when the Japanese came in. Was it 41? Yeah.
And December.
I think there were rumours that we were going to go to Malaya, Singapore, and that was a strong rumour which persisted until we, even when we were on the boat. But there was, we suddenly had these orders that the horses, the younger horses, had to go back to remount depot, that we were getting mechanised, and the older horses had to be shot. And that was one hell of a blow to... It was mainly the gun team horses that were shot, because they were older, bigger horses. And the guys were really crying their eyes out for days and nights on end, because you know, they had to lead their horses out, and then they were at the farrier, put the bolt in their heads. And we had, I think we must have had every vulture in India, and Shaitor came, you know, the Maidan, as it's called, a big field, about a mile or more across, outside of the barracks. It was covered with jackals and hyenas and vultures and kites.
Were the carcasses just left out?
They were just left in piles, yeah, I've got photographs of them. Bones.
And what about your horse?
Well, my horse, Gwen, 53, went back to remount depot. She was only about 5 years old. The most of the outriders were... They went back. But they wouldn't hand them over to the Indians. That's what we were asking. Why should they? Why can't we give them to the Indians? But then the answer was, well, if we give them to the Indians, they'll treat them and starve them, and so better to shoot them. That was the army order anyway.